理课堂听 class.com。
Model Test 12. Section A. Directions. In this section, you will hear 8 short conversations and 2 long conversations. At the end of each conversation, 1 or more questions will be asked about what was said. Both the conversation and the questions will be spoken only once.After each question, there will be a pause. During the pause, you must read the 4 choices marked A, B, C, and D, and decide which is the best answer. Then mark the corresponding letter on answer sheet 2 with a single line through the center. Now let's begin with the 8 short conversations. Question 11.We've been working on this proposal for so long that my eyes are starting to blur.
Why don't we get out of here? The green meadow around the library is good to your eyes. We can wrap it up late.
What does the woman suggest the man do? Question 12. Finally, I got the chance to put on my new suit tonight. I've got to leave a good impression with your family.
Come on, it's merely a family reunion, so jeans and t-shirts are just fine.
What does the woman imply?Question 13. The concert set a record for attendance.
I understand there wasn't an empty seat in the house. Can you imagine?
What can be inferred about the concert? Question 14. It never fails. It's raining hard outside, and I'm stuck without an umbrella.
I'd like to let you have mine, but I have to go out soon.
What does the woman imply? Question 15. Have you heard that Professor Jones is retiring?
Yes, the faculty won't find anyone to fill her shoes.
What does the woman imply about Professor Jones? Question 16. I'd like you to come with me to the opening of the photography exhibit.
I'm exhausted. You'll have to manage without me tonight.
What will the woman probably do? Question 17. Have you heard Cherry's solo at the graduation ceremony? She does have a voice of gold.
Doesn't she, though? I was certainly impressed.
What does the woman mean?Question 18. Of the 2 houses we've seen, which one do you think fits our needs better, the first one or the second one?
The second one. It seems very expensive, but in the long run it will save us money on the maintenance.
What does the woman say about her choice of house?
Now you'll hear two long conversations. Conversation 1.
What are you doing?
I'm ordering some filing cabinet out of a catalogue.
What do you need them for?
There's so much stuff piling up in my dormitory room. If I don't do something soon, I won't be able to move in there.
Do you usually order from a catalogue?
Sometimes. Why?
Oh, it's just in the history class today, we were talking about how the catalog sales business first got started in the U.S. A Chicago retailer, Montgomery Ward, started it in the late 1800s. It was really popular among farmers. It was difficult for them to make it to the big city stores, so they ordered from catalogs.
Was Ward the only one in the business?
At first, but another person named Richard Sears started his own catalog after he heard how much money Ward was making.
What made them so popular?
Farmers trusted Ward and Sears for one thing. They delivered the products the farmers paid for, and even refunded the price of things the farmers weren't satisfied with. The catalog became so popular that some country schools' teachers even used them as textbooks.
Textbooks?
Yeah, students practice spelling the names and adding up the prices of things in the catalogs.
Was everybody that thrilled about it?
That's doubtful. Say they drove some small store owners out of business. Sears and Ward sold stuff in such large quantities that they were able to undercut the prices at some small family-owned stores. Questions 19 to 21 are based on the conversation you have just heard. Question 19. What is the conversation mainly about? Question 20. In what unusual way were the catalogs used according to the conversation? Question 21. What was one of the negative effects of the catalog business? Conversation 2.
Hi, Jim. What are you doing?
Oh, hi, Linda. I'm working on a report on energy sources for my environmental science class, but I'm having trouble finding enough information.
You know, we were talking about sources of fuel in my class today.
Yeah?
Professor Collins, he's an authority on energy sources. He was telling us about a new way of getting fuel oil from coal.
I didn't know that was possible.
He said something about coal being set on fire and blasted with a mixture of steam and oxygen. This process produces a gas made up of hydrogen and carbon, the basic elements of oil.
And then they do something to change that gas to oil?
Right. First, since coal contains fewer hydrogen atoms than oil, they have to add some extra hydrogen to the gas. Then, impurities are washed out with methanol, I think, before this gas is sent on to reactors where it's changed into oil.
Since coal is so plentiful, I guess it won't be long till this new type of oil is available all over the place, huh?
I doubt it. Professor Collins said something about the process not be economically enough to use in this country. At any rate, you really ought to talk to him. He'll be able to help you more than I can. And he's got office hours all afternoon today.
Thanks. He's over in Anderson Hall, right?
Right. Questions 22 to 25 are based on the conversation you have just heard. Question 22. What are the students mainly discussing? Question 23. What happens in the process of the coal being burned, according to Professor Collins? Question 24. What does the woman mention as a disadvantage of the process she describes? Question 25. What will the man probably do this afternoon?
Section B. In this section, you will hear three short passages. At the end of each passage, you will hear some questions. Both the passage and the questions will be spoken only once. After you hear a question, you must choose the best answer from the four choices marked A, B, C, and D. Then mark the corresponding letter on answer sheet 2 with a single line through the center.
Passage 1. In the early 1800s, the paper industry was still using rags as the basic source of fiber, as it had for many centuries. However, the rag supply couldn't keep up with the growing demand for paper. The United States alone was using 250,000 tons of rags each year, and a quarter of that had to be imported. It was clear that the new source of fiber was needed to keep up with the demand for paper. The answer of this problem turned out to be paper made from wood pulp, something that was abundantly available in North America. In Canada, the first wood pulp mill was set up in 1866 and was immediately successful. But while wood pulp solved the problem of quantity, it created the problem of quality. Wood pulp contains a substance called lignin. The simplest way to make a large quantity of cheap paper involves leaving the lignin in the wood pulp, but that would shorten the life expectancy of paper from several centuries for rag paper to less than one century for paper made from wood pulp. This means that books printed less than 100 years ago are already turning yellow and beginning to disintegrate, even though books printed much earlier may be in fine condition. This is good enough for the older books on your bookshelf, but it poses a huge problem for libraries and collection of the government documents.
Questions 26 to 28 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 26. What does the speaker mainly discuss? Question 27. Why did the paper industry need a new source of fiber in the early 1800s? Question 28. According to the speaker, what is the problem with lignin? Passage 2. Marianne Moore once said that her writing could be called poetry only because there was no other name for it. Indeed, her poems appear to be extremely compressed essays. Her subjects were varied: animals, laborers, artists, and the craft of poetry. From her general reading came quotations that she found striking or insightful. She included these in her poems, enclosed in quotation marks or sometimes identified in footnotes. Of this practice, she wrote, "Why there aren't many quotation marks, I am asked. When a thing has been said so well that it could not be said better, why paraphrase it? Close observation and a concentration on detail are the methods of her poetry." Marianne Moore grew up in Kirkwood, Missouri, near St. Louis. After graduation from Bryn Mawr College in 1909, she taught commercial subjects at the Indian School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Later, she became a librarian in New York City. During the 1920s, she was editor of The Dial, an important literary magazine of the period. She lived quietly all her life, mostly in Brooklyn, New York. Her first book of poems was published in London in 1921 by a group of friends associated with the Imagist movement. From that time on, her poetry has been read with interest by succeeding generations of poets and readers. In 1952, she was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for her collected poems. She wrote that she did not write poetry for money or fame. To earn a living is needful, but it can be done in routine ways. One writes because one has a burning desire to express oneself.
Questions 29 to 31 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 29. What is the passage mainly about? Question 30. Which subject may appear in Moore's books? Question 31. Why did Moore write according to the passage? Passage 3. Centuries ago, man discovered that removing moisture from food helps to preserve it, and that the easiest way to do this is to expose the food to sun and wind. All foods contain water. Cabbage and other leaf vegetables contain as much as 93% water. Potatoes and other root vegetables, 80%. Lean meat, 75%. And fish, anything from 80 to 60%, depending on how fatty it is. If this water is removed, the activity of the bacteria which cause the food to go bad is checked. Nowadays, most foods are dried mechanically. The conventional method of such dehydration is to put food in chambers through which hot air is blown at temperatures of about 110 degrees centigrade at entry to about 43 degrees centigrade at exit. This is the usual method for drying such things as vegetables, minced meat, and fish. Dried foods take up less room and weigh less than the same food packed in cans or frozen, and they do not need to be stored in special conditions. For these reasons, they are invaluable to climbers, explorers, and soldiers in battle, who have little storage space. They are also popular with housewives because it takes so little time to cook them. Usually, it is just a case of replacing the dried-out moisture with boiling water.
Questions 32 to 35 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 32. How much water does cabbage contain? Question 33. If this water is removed, what would happen to food? Question 34. What do people use for drying food like vegetables, minced meat, and fish in the usual method? Question 35. Which of the following statements is true about drying food?
Section C. Directions. In this section, you will hear a passage three times. When the passage is read for the first time, you should listen carefully for its general idea. When the passage is read for the second time, you are required to fill in the blanks numbered from 36 to 43 with the exact words you have just heard. For blanks numbered from 44 to 46, you are required to fill in the missing information. For these blanks, you can either use the exact words you have just heard or write down the main points in your own words. Finally, when the passage is read for the third time, you should check what you have written. Now listen to the passage.
Sleep is very ancient. In the electroencephalographic sense, we share it with all the primates and almost all the other mammals and birds. It may extend back as far as the reptiles. There is some evidence that the two types of sleep, dreaming and dreamless, depend on the lifestyle of the animal, and that predators are statistically much more likely to dream than prey, which are in turn much more likely to experience dreamless sleep. In dream sleep, the animal is powerfully immobilized and remarkably unresponsive to external stimuli. Dreamless sleep is much shallower, and we have all witnessed cats or dogs cocking their ears to a sound when apparently fast asleep. The fact that deep dream sleep is rare among prey today seems clearly to be a product of natural selection, and it makes sense that today, when sleep is highly evolved, the stupid animals are less frequently immobilized by deep sleep than the smart ones. But why should they sleep deeply at all? Why should a state of such deep immobilization have ever evolved? Perhaps one useful hint about the original function of sleep is to be found in some facts, like dolphins and whales and aquatic mammals, in general, seem to sleep very little. There is, by and large, no place to hide in the ocean. Could it be that, rather than increasing an animal's vulnerability, the University of Florida and Ray Mettis of Lennon University have suggested this to be the case?
Now the passage will be read again. Sleep is very ancient. In the electroencephalographic sense, we share it with all the primates and almost all the other mammals and birds. It may extend back as far as the reptiles. There is some evidence that two types of sleep, dreaming and dreamless, depend on the lifestyle of the animal, and that predators are statistically much more likely to dream than prey, which are in turn much more likely to experience dreamless sleep. In dream sleep, the animal is powerfully immobilized and remarkably unresponsive to external stimuli. Dreamless sleep is much shallower. We have all witnessed our cats or dogs cocking their ears to a sound when apparently fast asleep. The fact that deep dream sleep is rare among prey today seems clearly to be a product of natural selection. And it makes sense that today, when sleep is highly evolved, the stupid animals are less frequently immobilized by deep sleep than the smart ones. But why should they sleep deeply at all? Why should a state of such deep immobilization have ever evolved? Perhaps one useful hint about the original function of sleep is to be found in some facts. Like dolphins and whales and aquatic mammals in general seem to sleep very little. There is, by and large, no place to hide in the ocean. Could it be that, rather than increasing an animal's vulnerability, the University of Florida and Ray Medis of London University have suggested this to be the case?
Now the passage will be read for the third time. Sleep is very ancient. In the electroencephalographic sense, we share it with all the primates and almost all the other mammals and birds. It may extend back as far as the reptiles. There is some evidence that the two types of sleep, dreaming and dreamless, depend on the lifestyle of the animal, and that predators are statistically much more likely to dream than prey, which are in turn much more likely to experience dreamless sleep. In dream sleep, the animal is powerfully immobilized and remarkably unresponsive to external stimuli. Dreamless sleep is much shallower, and we have all witnessed cats or dogs cocking their ears to a sound when apparently fast asleep. The fact that deep dream sleep is rare among prey today seems clearly to be a product of natural selection, and it makes sense that today, when sleep is highly evolved, the stupid animals are less frequently immobilized by deep sleep than the smart ones. But why should they sleep deeply at all? Why should a state of such deep immobilization have ever evolved? Perhaps one useful hint about the original function of sleep is to be found in some facts, like dolphins and whales and aquatic mammals in general seem to sleep very little. There is, by and large, no place to hide in the ocean. Could it be that, rather than increasing an animal's vulnerability, the University of Florida and Ray Medis of London University have suggested this to be the case? ¶¶